Greetings, this is Tyler McFeeters with your News Gazette, dated Friday, March 20th, 2026. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. Illini in the NCAA tournament. Madness begins. Greenville, South Carolina. Actually, the story is a busy band, two tournaments and trip to Ireland, out of Greenville, South Carolina. Annalise Fajardo and Andrea Salazar had plenty of fun during the first few days of their trip to South Carolina. The freshmen were among the 23 members of the Illinois Hoops band that made the 650-mile journey to cheer on the Illini in their sixth consecutive NCAA men's basketball tournament appearance. I was already preparing to come on this trip to begin with, so when they let us know, I was ready to go and, of course, very excited to be here, Salazar said. The last week has been a busy one for Illinois' band program. About 360 of its members are on a six-day trip to Ireland, while those stateside are split between the men's NCAA tournament in Greenville and the women's tournament in Nashville, Tennessee. The UI men's team opened its March Madness stint on Thursday night against Penn, while the women will face Colorado on Saturday night at Memorial Gymnasium. We're dealing with half of our band being in Ireland, Fajardo said, so we already knew we were going to be on this trip. We just didn't really know where until a couple days' notice before, but it's really exciting. I'm glad to be here to support the team. Band director Barry Hauser was on the Emerald Isle, leaving Reed Laisley to direct the group in Greenville. Laisley did the same 4 years ago during the band's last visit to Ireland, which happened at the same time as the Illinois men's basketball team was playing in the NCAA tournament in Pittsburgh. I love college basketball, Laisley said. I love March Madness, so I was happy to volunteer to stay behind and lead the band. Laisley has had plenty of moving pieces to organize between the time that brackets were unveiled Sunday evening and when the men's band departed for South Carolina. Hauser was heavily involved in the basketball band's operations from Ireland in spite of being a few time zones away. Professor Hauser has been putting in a lot of work while he was in Ireland, so we appreciate that, Laisley said. But ultimately, it all boils down to the hard work that athletics has done, along with the basketball team, all the event planning that goes into it. On our part, it's just making sure that the music is ready to go and the band's sounding good. But other than that, a lot of support that we've been getting outside has been really instrumental. Fajardo has played in the Illinois women's basketball band for most of the season, but subbed for the men's band for a handful of regular season games. I've really gotten to follow the men's team very well, and getting to know the players, and also the people in the men's band, has been a really great opportunity, Fajardo said. Salazar is a music education player from Aurora who plays the trumpet, while Fajardo is an Oswego native who studies interdisciplinary health sciences and plays the clarinet. A short trip to United Center in Chicago was another highlight of their first year at Illinois, while the duo enjoyed Greenville's array of shops and restaurants with their per diem cards. It was a free trip for the band members as opposed to the Ireland trip that cost roughly $4,000 per member. We get opportunities that a lot of people don't, and my dad has always wanted to go to an NCAA tournament, Fajardo said. I'm 19 years old, and I'm going to my first one before he is. Being a part of the band, you get to support the team in a way that other people can't. Each has enjoyed a front row seat for plenty of Illinois victories. The men's team entered March Madness with a number 3 seed in the South region, while the women's team is a number 7 seed in the Fort Worth 1 region. I like watching the games, Salazar said. I've played at almost every game, and it's just exciting. Joey Wright is a reporter covering prep and college sports for the News Gazette and WWS, WHMS, WKIO Radio. The next front page story is University of Illinois. Trustees approve new law program and more. Several specialized faculty hirings okayed. Story by Luke Taylor, out of Urbana. Among items approved by the University of Illinois Board of Trustees at its Thursday meeting was a new law degree to be offered online through the Urbana-Champaign campus. It's not a Juris Doctor degree, the one aspiring lawyers must pursue, It's also not a Master of Laws program that allows lawyers to specialize. The University of Illinois already offers that. This Master of Science in Law is designed for non-lawyers, folks who aren't interested in a JD degree, to pursue education in law to advance their career in business, technology, and/or compliance. The proposal for the program presented to trustees also compared it to a master's degree in business administration, but said that the difference is the MS in law will focus more on legal strategy than general management. The courses for this program will be exclusive to graduate students, and the university will hire 3 specialized faculty members to support it. Though the bulk of course creation would be provided by a combination of current College of Law faculty and the college's established adjunct program, the plan for the program is to include guardrails to ensure minimal impact on the college's existing faculty's capacity to support the core JD program, the proposal said. UI's College of Law moved to add this program after a consultant study determined that it could target people seeking to gain legal skills for their jobs, people seeking promotions via legal expertise, and people entering or transitioning into legal-adjacent roles. Other degree changes approved by the trustees intend to have even more minimal impact. For example, the current Bachelor's of Science in Community Health will be replaced one-to-one with a new BS in Public Health. Another brand new program will be a Doctor of Social Work in Social Work, building on current offerings in the School of Social Work. While the school currently offers bachelor's and master's programs in social work, the doctoral level offering is a Doctor of Philosophy in Social Work. This new DSW will be designed for students intending to pursue professional practice rather than research. Rather than a thesis, the program will culminate in a practice-based capstone project that addresses a leadership challenge, organizational need, or systems-level issue, according to the proposal. The school will bring on an additional adjunct instructor to cover courses impacted by the reallocation, and a current faculty member will assume the role of program director. Other new programs will include Masters of Science degrees in Policy Economics, Neuroscience, and Economic Modeling, AI, and Data Science. The latter, under the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, is designed to help graduates take part in a growing field of economists using data science, including AI and machine learning, to tackle complicated problems and generate more accurate forecasts. And the final story on the front page is Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District. Vote set on annexations bringing service to Carl on Curtis. Story by Jana Wiersema. Out of Champaign. The Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District Board will vote next week on 3 annexations, including 2 that would enable buses to serve Carl Champaign on Curtis. The proposed areas: Liberty on the Lake, approximately 175 acres of land in this subdivision, including the Carl facility. The Illinois Power Ameren Tract, about 4 acres north of the clinic. And Cherry Hills, about 33 acres near the Champaign subdivision. Public hearings for all 3 areas were held this week. MTD Managing Director Carl Gnatt said in a previous interview that voluntary annexations have also aided the district in its goal of providing service to Carl Champaign on Curtis. Gnatt said state law restricts transit districts from annexing parcels that are non-contiguous to district boundaries or taxed as farmland, which has posed an obstacle to that goal. In this case, all of the properties that were contiguous to our boundaries and in between Carl and the district are taxed as farmland, Gnatt said. It wasn't until landowners of some of the farmland voluntarily agreed to be annexed that we could access the Carl property. We're grateful for their willingness to support their community. The MTD board previously voted in February to approve a couple of voluntary annexations for this purpose. And we'll turn now to national and world news. Mideast conflict, volatile situation. Israel pledges to avoid further strikes on key Iranian gas field after Iran begins Gulf-wide retaliatory campaign. Out of Dubai and the United Arab Emirates and the AP. Israel pounded Tehran with airstrikes Friday as Iranians marked Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, in the midst of a war that has sent shockwaves through the global economy and risked drawing Iran's Arab neighbors directly into the conflict. Activists reported hearing strikes around Iran's capital. The attacks came a day after Israel pledged to refrain from more strikes on a key Iranian gas field, and Iran intensified attacks on oil and natural gas facilities around the Gulf. Heavy explosions shook Dubai early Friday as air defenses intercepted incoming fire over the city, where people were observing Eid al-Fitr, the end of the holy Muslim fasting month of Ramadan, and mosques made the day's first call to prayers. Iran kept up its wave of attacks launched at Israel that have sent millions of people to shelters, with sirens sounding across the wide swath of the north, from Haifa to the Galilee to the border with Lebanon. It came after an intense day that saw more than a dozen missile launches on Thursday alone, according to Israel's military. Global fuel supplies have been under intense pressure because of Iran's stranglehold on the Strait of Hormuz, a strategic waterway through which a fifth of the world's oil is transported. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said late Thursday that, at the request of President Donald Trump, Israel will hold off any further attacks on Iran's offshore South Pars gas field. Iranian strikes in retaliation have led to already elevated global energy prices further surging and spurred Gulf allies to call for Trump to rein in Netanyahu. Since the U.S. and Israel launched the war on February 28th, Iran's top leaders have been killed and the country's military capabilities have been severely degraded. Netanyahu said in a televised address that Iran no longer has the ability to enrich uranium or make ballistic missiles, though he did not provide evidence. Still, Iran, now led by the son of the supreme leader killed in the war's opening salvo, remains capable of missile and drone attacks. Brent crude oil, the international standard, briefly surged above $119 a barrel, up more than 60% since the war started. The European benchmark for natural gas prices also rose sharply and has roughly doubled in the past month. The United Nations Security Council held an urgent closed meeting Thursday during which Persian Gulf countries stressed the need for Iran to halt attacks on them, said Bahrain's UN Ambassador Jamal al-Rawayi, the Arab representative to the UN's most powerful body. But Iran has showed no signs of backing down. Saudi Arabia said its Samref refinery in the Red Sea port city of Yanbu was hit. Saudi Arabia had begun pumping large volumes of oil west toward the Red Sea to avoid the Strait of Hormuz. Qatar, a key source of natural gas for world markets, said Iranian missiles that caused extensive damage at the Ras Laffan liquefied natural gas facility reduced its exports by about 17% and will cost about $20 billion in lost revenue a year. The damage will take up to 5 years to repair, even though production at the facility had already been halted after earlier attacks. Two oil refineries in Kuwait and gas operations in Abu Dhabi also were targeted by Iran, authorities said. Underscoring the danger to ships in the region, a vessel was set ablaze Thursday off the United Arab Emirates coast, and another was damaged off Qatar. Efforts to bypass the strait were also under pressure. An Iranian drone hit a Saudi refinery on the Red Sea, which the country had hoped to use as an alternative route. Meanwhile, the UAE said Friday it disrupted what it called a terrorist network funded and operated by Lebanon's Hezbollah and Iran, arresting its operatives. It accused the men of laundering money while operating within the country under a fictitious commercial cover that sought to carry out schemes that would threaten the country's financial stability. It published images of five prisoners on its state-run WAM news agency without identifying the men. At Thursday's news conference, Netanyahu said, "Iran's air defenses have been rendered useless. Their navy is lying at the bottom of the sea. Their air force is nearly destroyed." He said he hopes the Iranian people will rise up against the Islamic Republic that has ruled for nearly a half century. There's been no sign of any organized opposition since the war began after Iranian authorities crushed mass protests in January. The Prime Minister's comments to foreign journalists came amid difficult days for Trump and Netanyahu, with a top U.S. intelligence official resigning and claiming Israel pushed Trump into the war, and Israel's attacks on South Pars, which led to Iran's retaliatory strikes on the region's oil and gas fields. "I misled no one," Netanyahu said, "and I didn't have to convince President Trump about the need to prevent Iran from developing its nuclear program." General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that U.S. forces were attacking deeper into Iranian territory, with warplanes hunting Iranian boats in the strait and dropping 5,000-pound bombs on underground weapons storage facilities. Iran condemned Israel's attack on South Pars, the Iranian part of the world's largest gas field, located offshore in the Persian Gulf and owned jointly with Qatar. With some 80% of power generated in Iran coming from natural gas, according to the International Energy Agency, the attack threatens the country's electricity supplies. After Trump requested Israel not attack South Pars, he also warned on social media that if Iran continued striking Qatar, the U.S. would massively blow up the entirety of the field. Asked later about the possibility of U.S. ground troops being deployed in Iran, Trump responded, "No, I'm not putting troops anywhere." More than 1,300 people in Iran have been killed during the war. Israeli strikes against the Iranian-backed Hezbollah militant group in Lebanon have displaced more than 1 million people, according to the Lebanese government, which says more than 1,000 people have been killed. Israel says it has killed more than 500 Hezbollah militants. In Israel, 15 people have been killed by Iranian missile fire. 4 were also killed in the occupied West Bank by an Iranian missile strike overnight. At least 13 U.S. military members have been killed. And another story on that same page. It takes money to kill bad guys. Pentagon allegedly wants $200 billion more for Iran war. Out of Washington in the AP. The Pentagon is seeking $200 billion in additional funds for the Iran war, a sizable amount that is certain to be met with questions from Congress, which would need to approve any new money. The department sent the request to the White House, according to a senior administration official, who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the private information. Asked about the figure at a press conference Thursday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth did not directly confirm the amount, saying it could change. "It takes money to kill bad guys," Hegseth said. But he said, "We're going back to Congress and our folks there to ensure that we're properly funded." It's an extraordinarily high number and comes on top of extra funding the Defense Department already received last year in President Donald Trump's big tax cuts bill. Such a request would need to be approved by Congress, and it is not at all clear such spending would have political support. The nation's debt has surged past a record $39 trillion. Congress has been bracing for a new spending request, but it is not clear the White House has transmitted the request for consideration. Lawmakers have not authorized the war, and Congress is showing growing unease with the military operation's scope and strategy. The new funding request was first reported by the Washington Post. Trump said the administration is asking for the money for other reasons beyond Iran. "This is a very volatile world," the president said from the Oval Office. He said the emergency spending would be a very small price to pay to ensure the nation's military stays in top shape. On the next page of national and world news, energy crisis, informal blockade effectively crippling Cuban population. Out of Miami in the AP. The Cuban Communist Party has shown an astonishing resilience over six decades in power. Whether it's United States trade embargo to counter Fidel Castro's 1959 revolution, or the widespread starvation of the special period that followed the breakup of its Cold War patron, the Soviet Union, both U.S. hostilities and calamities of its own making have proven no match for the country's leadership. But perhaps none of these crises pose as grave a threat as the one triggered by an all-but-declared naval siege by the Trump administration as it seeks to force regime change in the wake of its successful ousting of Cuba's longtime ally, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Even as he fights a war with Iran, President Donald Trump this week said he believes he'll have the honor of taking Cuba soon. While it wasn't clear exactly what he meant, the U.S. is looking for President Miguel Díaz-Canel to leave power as part of ongoing talks with Havana that could avert some kind of U.S. military intervention. Without declaring a formal blockade, Trump and his administration have already crippled trade with the island. In March, supplies of oil, food, and other goods to the island collapsed, with no foreign originating tankers arriving to Cuba, according to shipping data analyzed by Windward, a maritime intelligence firm. The volume of port calls, which includes tankers moving from one Cuban port to another, averaged about 50 per month in 2025, but fell to just 11 in March, all of them arriving from domestic ports. It was the lowest since 2017. Moreover, little relief is in sight, with no tankers and only three container ships originating in China, India, and the Netherlands, listing Cuba as their intended harbor. On Thursday, the Associated Press reported that two vessels, one of them sanctioned by the U.S., could arrive in the coming days carrying Russian fuel. The stranglehold is disrupting the lives of Cuba's 11 million residents, who are enduring massive blackouts and a breakdown of medical care due to a lack of fuel to power ambulances and hospital generators. The country, one of the most heavily reliant in the world on oil to generate electricity, produces barely 40% of the oil needed to cover its energy needs. Ian Ralby, head of IR Consilium, a U.S.-based consultancy focused on maritime security, said the United States' aggressiveness will not endear Trump to Cubans long eager for change. Every Cuban resident is suffering the acute inaccessibility to fuel and all the knock-on consequences in terms of access to food, hospitals, and free movement, he said. The sudden halt in trade has taken place without the White House reapplying restrictions on exports to Cuba that were last loosened during the Biden administration. Indeed, shipments of U.S.-produced poultry, pork, and other foodstuffs to Cuba, which account for the vast majority of U.S. exports to the country, last year soared to 490 million, the most since 2009. Non-agricultural exports and humanitarian donations, much of it to Cuba's emerging private sector, more than doubled. But emboldened by the U.S. capture of Maduro, Trump has gradually escalated his rhetoric on Cuba, first suggesting he would pursue a friendly takeover of the country, and more recently telling conservative allies from Latin America that he would take care of Cuba once the war with Iran winds down. While neither he nor the administration has articulated what exactly the pledge means, the continued presence in the Caribbean of U.S. warships used in the strike against Maduro has led companies and countries that do business with Cuba to self-police. Nobody wants to be on the radar of Trump's Truth Social account, said John Kavulich, president of the New York-based U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Council. In the run-up to the U.S. military's ousting of Maduro during a nighttime raid on January 3rd, Trump declared that the U.S. would block all Venezuelan oil shipments to Cuba and even seized a few tankers to enforce what it called a quarantine, borrowing a term used by President John F. Kennedy during the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. Later in the month, Trump signed an executive order threatening tariffs on any country that supplies oil to Cuba. Next story on National and World News. U.S. Government. Panel advances Mullen's nomination as DHS chief. Senator Fetterman crossed party lines in support. Out of Washington in the AP. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen moved a step closer to becoming President Donald Trump's next Homeland Security Secretary after a Senate committee Thursday narrowly advanced his nomination. The 8-7 vote came after a contentious hearing Wednesday and sent the cabinet nomination to the full Senate, which could act to confirm the Oklahoma Republican next week. That vote included a no from the Republican chairman, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, and a yes from a Democrat, Senator John Fetterman of Pennsylvania. The approval comes as the parties are fighting bitterly over the policies of the Department of Homeland Security, leading to a funding lapse that is now in its 34th day. During his testimony before the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, Mullen tried to make the case that he would be a steady hand after the tumultuous tenure of Kristi Noem, Trump's first DHS secretary. Mullen also signaled support for Trump's immigration priorities, which are central to the funding standoff after the deaths of at least three American citizens at the hands of federal agents. Mullen's hearing was unusually combative and came close to going off the rails as he engaged in heated exchanges with some Democrats as well as Paul. In addition to a lengthy exchange over Mullen's failure to disclose what he characterized as a classified congressional trip while a House member, Paul opened the hearing with a fiery statement challenging Mullen's fitness to lead DHS. Paul pointed to comments Mullen made after a funding fight when he called Paul a freaking snake and said he understood why a neighbor had attacked Paul in a lawn care dispute. That incident happened several years ago, and Paul suffered multiple broken ribs and later had surgeries he linked to the attack. I just wonder if someone who applauds violence against their political opponents is the right person to lead an agency that has struggled to accept limits to the proper use of force, Paul said. Mullins refused to back down. For you to say I'm a liar, sir, that's not accurate, Mullins said. Paul later said he would not vote for Mullins' confirmation. Fetterman, who has frequently challenged his own party, said his vote was rooted in a strong, committed, constructive working relationship with Senator Mullen for our nation's security. And the last story on this page of the National and World News, Spring Break Tragedy, Spanish Police, Missing Illinoisan's Body Found. Story out of Barcelona in Spain in the AP. The body of James Jimmy Gracie, a University of Alabama student from the Chicago suburbs who went missing in Spain on spring break, was found Thursday in the water off a Barcelona beach, police said. Gracie's body was found by police divers and positively identified, the press office for Catalonia's regional police in Barcelona told the Associated Press. The University of Alabama student's body was found near where he was last seen outside a nightclub with his friends early Tuesday. He was visiting friends in Barcelona for spring break. Catalan police said their investigation continues into the cause of death. Gracie, 20, was last seen outside the Xoco nightclub in Barcelona, but separated from friends around 3 a.m. Tuesday. He never returned to the room he was renting with friends, according to family members who live in the Chicago suburb of Elmhurst. They realized something was wrong when police contacted him, saying they had recovered his phone. In a statement released late Thursday, the Gracie family asked for prayers and privacy. Our family is heartbroken as we confirm that Jimmy's body has been recovered in Barcelona. Jimmy was a deeply loved son, grandson, brother, nephew, cousin, and friend, and our family is struggling to come to terms with this unimaginable loss, the statement said. We are profoundly grateful for the outpouring of love, support, and prayers from people around the world. As we navigate this painful time, we kindly ask for privacy so that we may grieve together and begin to process this loss as a family. In an interview conducted before police confirmed his death, Gracie's aunt told the Associated Press that he was just a great kid, a good Catholic boy from the Midwest. Very good student, honors program at University of Alabama, chaplain in his fraternity, you know, just an amazing older brother and role model to his cousins, Beth Marin O'Reilly said. O'Reilly said her nephew left Alabama on Thursday and spent the weekend in Amsterdam before arriving Monday in Barcelona. Gracie's family did not immediately know how police came into possession of his phone. Gracie's father, Taras, is in Barcelona and has been working with police, O'Reilly said. And we will take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette, dated Friday, March 20th, 2026. Please stay tuned.